This is Jim Inkster, and welcome to Talk Louisiana, signature support from the Office of Mayor President of East Baton Rouge Parish, Sharon Weston Broom, and signature support comes from the office, of which no commentary on this show is affected by our support from that particular office. The show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge, and we're joined by one of the leading journalistic lights in America, David Reynolds Ignatius, American journalist and novelist, associate editor, columnist for the Washington Post. He's known for fiction and nonfiction. He has penned at least 11 best-selling novels. His latest is Phantom Orbit, a thriller that only Mr. Ignatius could pen. And good morning to you, sir. It's good to visit with you. It's been a few years. Nice to hear your distinctive voice.
Thank you, Jim. It's great to be back with you.
Well, David Ignatius, you are a double threat if there ever was one. Many people are good at fiction and would never go in the realm of traditional journalism, and the other way around, of course, is more evident. But you do both, and you have stated, and I think you have written, that the process is much different.
So there are obviously very different kinds of writing. In my case, the two, I think, balance each other pretty well. I have been a journalist since 1976. I love reporting, although I'm an opinions columnist now for the Washington Post. I'm not all that opinionated a guy. I like is finding out things that are new. And then I found that in my fiction, my first novel was published in 1987, I had a chance to unpack the things that I discovered as a reporter and think about them, think about the characters and, you know, the environment in which events take place. The news story can be so dry and dense. The novel, if it's a good one, is rich and the characters really come to life in your mind. So now for all those years, 40 years, I've been doing both. I thought when I was a kid that I had to choose, Jim, between one or the other, being a journalist or a novelist. I just couldn't make up my mind, and I feel really lucky that I didn't make that choice because I've been very happy to do both of them.
And, of course, you have knowledge that is unique to you, as we all do, but you have been at the inner sanctum of American government going back to your days as a kid. Your dad, Paul, was quite a force in the government, in the Defense Department, and I would imagine that shaped the man and the writer you are.
Without question. My dad, Paul Ignatius, is still alive at 103.
Isn't that amazing?
He's one of the last living members of the Kennedy administration who served in the Pentagon. He was in a number of positions during the 60s, but ended up as Secretary of the Navy, which is obviously a very senior position. He has a great big Aegis class destroyer that's named after him that was built in Pascagoula, not so far from you.
No.
So there's no question that growing up in my dad's house, surrounded by the world of Washington, shaped me. I didn't end up going into the military. I sometimes regret that, but there is a way, I hope, and that journalism, working hard, I've covered a lot of conflicts overseas in my career, does something that's useful for the public, even though it's not really public service in the traditional sense.
Well, in your latest book, Phantom Orbit, the Cold War is still evident in our world today and still evident in your writing, and Russia and China are in the book to a great degree. And I have noted that quite often your fiction is something that is sometimes prophetic in the real world. And what you describe in Phantom Orbit, I think, may be a harbinger of things to come and may be a concern for those who read your book.
Yeah, so I should just say to your listeners, I think that we are entering an era of space warfare. The next war will surely begin in space. It may end there. The Ukraine war, in many ways, is our first space war. People don't realize it, but an American company, Elon Musk's Starlink, is providing the broadband internet coverage that allows the Ukrainian military to operate. They simply couldn't function in these battle zones without the broadband signals they're getting from Elon Musk and his company. There are many other aspects of satellite technology that are part of this war. The Ukrainians get their intelligence from commercial satellites that pass over Ukraine multiple times a day. They can dial down the orbits they want to look at. They use optical imaging satellites for targeting. They use thermal imaging satellites for locating specific Russian tanks or artillery pieces. The Russians have been late to get into this game, and they have nothing like the American capability in space, but they're learning how to jam signals, make it difficult for the Ukrainians to operate. So in that war, it's a terrible war. I've been four times to Ukraine since the war began. Each time it's more painful to watch it, but it is a more of a technology war than people may realize watching it from afar.
Phantom Orbit follows Ivan Volkov, a Russian student in Beijing who discovers an unsolved puzzle in the writings of a 17th century astronomer, and it is quite a ride, and Volkov is quite a character. Where did he come from?
So I have always been fascinated by Russia. As I say in the acknowledgments at the end of the book, there's a way through the character of Volkov that the book is a love letter to the Russia that was before Putin began to destroy it, and I hope it may be again. The book opens with Volkov in the present time, after the war in Ukraine has begun, realizing, he believes, that Russia and China have developed what he calls a kill switch that can turn off GPS signals on which we in America and the West depend for everything. Every time we use our mobile phones, we're using GPS without realizing it. Every time an airplane flies, it's using GPS for navigation. Virtually every transaction is linked to this system overhead. So he decides he needs to share this information with the CIA, sends a message at great risk, and there's no answer. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to hear what he has to say. So one of the riddles of the book is, why is that? Why does it open with his plea, take this seriously, that nobody wants to respond to?
Well, Volkov ultimately makes a decision to contact the CIA, and one reviewer says, Ignatius addresses our moment of renewed interest in space exploration amid geopolitical tumult. Phantom Orbit brims with the author's vital insights and casts Volkov as the man who, at the risk of his life, may be able to stop the doomsday clock. We have so many weapons at the disposal of nations, both stable and unstable. It is an uncertain world, and if we really thought about it, it might drive us crazy. But I think in your pages, in many books, and including this one, you capture where we are now, David.
Well, Jim, the way in which technology keeps being applied to weapon systems and our military balance is frightening. War is becoming more and more lethal. The level of death and destruction in Ukraine is—we haven't seen anything like that since World War II. It's horrifying. I do think that America's greatest protection in a world where, unfortunately, we do have countries that want to do us ill, is that we're still dominant in technology. There's something about the American economy, our openness, the way in which people with good ideas think they can get rich, that they can make a difference inventing products here, gives us an edge. All you have to do is look at AI. In the last year, we've had a revolution in these AI large language models, and it's all in the U.S. Other countries are just desperately trying to keep up, including China, which people worried was about to overtake us. But yeah, we still have a lead. I do think we need one reason I wanted to write about space weapons and the way in which this new technology is becoming so important is that people need to think about how to limit it. The Russians have an idea of trying to stop our advances in space weapons by exploding a nuclear bomb in low Earth orbit that would just turn low Earth orbit, where all the communication satellites, all of Elon Musk's satellites are, into just a big junkyard where nothing could fly for decades. And there need to be international rules to prevent that. The idea of turning space, empty, beautiful, heavenly realm into a junkyard full of debris is a very sad thought. So this is a time when, yeah, we're developing new systems. We also ought to be developing new laws and new treaties too.
David Ignatius, a man born in 1950, is a man of his time, and that means this time. A subtle and masterful novel from the prescient voice on the cutting edge of spy literature. The latest is Phantom Orbit, the thriller from David Ignatius. Thank you, sir, and keep going.
You inspire me. Thank you, Jim. Great to talk to you. Thank you.
See you soon. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, your number. 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. And Dan Moldea, the intrepid reporter who changed the trajectory of the careers of Newt Gingrich and Bob Livingston and David Vitter, with his reporting about salacious elements in their lives, is here to talk with us about the latest regarding former President Donald John Trump. He was in his hometown yesterday. I'm told only about 100 people are in the Manhattan courthouse, and most of them are reporters. And of course, there are jurors and a judge and attorneys on both sides. And the descriptions of what happened when Stormy Daniels, the former Stephanie Clifford, pride of Baton Rouge, took the stand yesterday, to show you how journalists can look at things happening contemporaneously and report a little bit differently. Here's the example. Four reporters from the Washington Post collaborated, and this was their perspective. With Donald Trump sitting just feet away, Stormy Daniels testified at the former president's hush money trial about a sexual encounter the porn actor says they had in 2006 that resulted in her being paid to keep silent during the presidential race 10 years later. Jurors appeared riveted as Daniels offered a detailed and at times graphic account of the encounter Trump has denied. Trump stared straight ahead when Daniels entered the courtroom, later whispering to his lawyers and shaking his head as she testified. That's from the Associated Press. This is from the New York Times. Donald J. Trump met Stormy Daniels. Their flirtation seemed fleeting. He was a 60-year-old married mogul at the peak of reality television fame. She was 27, not half his age, a Louisiana native raised in poverty and headed to pornographic stardom. But that chance encounter in Lake Tahoe, Nevada, some two decades ago, set off a chain of events that has brought the nation the first criminal trial of an American president. On Tuesday, Ms. Daniels took the stand at that trial, bringing the former president face-to-face with the porn star at the case's center. And finally, from the Washington Post, all of these front page stories, by the way, and the Post gets the alliteration award for today. Porn star Daniels details Trump tryst. Donald Trump greeted adult film actress Stormy Daniels in silky pajamas at his penthouse suite in a Lake Tahoe hotel in 2006, she told jurors at his hush money trial. I said, "Does Mr. Hefner know you stole his pajamas?" Daniels recalled, joking when she saw him, referring to Hugh Hefner, the founder of Playboy magazine, who was known for wearing a similar outfit. Daniels testified that the two later had sex, but she was in shock afterwards, saying her hand shook nervously as she tried to buckle her high-heeled gold shoes. Before she left, Trump told her he wanted to keep in touch. "Let's keep in touch, honey bunch." That's apparently the pet name that he used for her based on her account. Now, is she credible? And if she is, how much of this salacious detail will play well with the jury or not so well? It could offend some members of the jury. And remember, it only takes one to get a hung jury, which I'm sure is what the former president is attempting to get. Dan Moldea, I know you were watching with interest. What's your perspective?
Jim, how are you today?
Fine.
Donald Trump sort of invited all of this to happen by his blatant denial over all this time that any of this ever happened. And when and I may be wrong about this, but I'm under the impression that his defense team said in their opening arguments to the jury that Trump had denied the affair with Stormy Daniels. I'm under that impression. Now, if true, then whatever the prosecution brought in with Stormy Daniels with regard to the salacious details of the affair was justified because they had to prove that this Trump tryst, as you said, existed, that it actually happened. And so they did what they had to do. The problem was is Stormy Daniels, who's very smart, was speaking very quickly, and it was very difficult for the prosecution to rein her in while she was testifying. She wasn't being coached, but at the same time, it was difficult to get her it was so frustrating. Even the judge stepped in and said, you know, less detail, please. And as a consequence, that gave plenty of ammunition to the knuckle draggers at Fox News and among the MAGA crowd to claim that there was that this was salacious material for the purpose of being salacious material. No, it was very much a part of this case. And as a consequence of that, she delivered to the prosecution what they needed to have, but at the same time, she went overboard to the point where it's possible that she turned off some of the jurors. So we're going to have to wait and see about that. Meantime, Trump's acting up in court, from what I understand, was such that caused a lot of chaos within the courtroom because he was cursing and he was, you know, as you said, he was motioning and it was in plain view of the jury. And he was admonished by the judge, apparently during a sidebar, or at least he asked his lawyer to admonish his client to hold that thing down. I mean, right now, Trump's on the head of a pin right now. He's about to be sentenced to jail and for contempt. And he keeps on pushing. I mean, anybody else who had committed all these acts of contempt of court would be in jail right now. And so I think the judges doesn't want to take that action because he knows that more chaos will follow. But I think he's finding himself in a position where he's going to have no choice. And he's going to probably, the first time will probably be, they'll put him in a lockup in the back of the courtroom or something during the lunch hour. But then he's going to continue to act up as this trial goes on for the next 2 weeks. And believe me, if Karen McDougal testifies, she's going to pale anything Stormy Daniels says. By Karen McDougal is the one with the big story to tell. And I'll be very curious to see if the prosecution calls her and has her testify as well. What do you think?
Well, I would think she will testify. And she, unlike Stormy, said she was in love with Donald Trump and the relationship.
10 months. 10 months.
10 months, yeah. 10 months. Not 10 minutes, if that.
Right.
As Stormy said, it was very quick for Donald Trump. A listener, and by the way, if you'd like to get in, 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org, says, why would the prosecution want to put on such a tawdry tale of the Trump tryst like that as far as alliteration? But there could be any number of motivations for this, and one would be perhaps they were counting on Trump just losing it and making a fool of himself in the courtroom, and he apparently got close. But he didn't stand up and go nuts, and that may have been I can't read their minds, but I think the prosecution, of course, was trying to get a reaction from the former president.
Well, once again, they're saying that Stormy Daniels, the Fox News crowd, who looked like their dogs died yesterday as all of this was going on, and they were there defending him, you know, in every way possible, saying that the only innocent person in that room was Donald Trump. You know, again, Donald Trump invited all of this chaos by his denial that this tryst had occurred. And again, this is one of the pillars from what I understand of the defense opening argument that Trump had no relationship with this woman. And as a consequence of that, the prosecution had no choice. They had to prove that the relationship existed. And if they hadn't put that on, the jurors would have said, well, where's their woman to say, yeah, this is what happened. So I think the prosecution did the right. I think the judge is handling this trial very well. I think the prosecutors are handling this trial very well. I think the defense is probably doing it the best they can, considering the fact they're dealing with an impossible client. But at the same time, this impossible client has now managed to somehow worm his way out of the classified documents case down in Florida with the judge he appears to have in his pocket. Fannie, the DA down in Atlanta,
Bonnie Willis,
moron who had this affair with the lead prosecutor in the Trump RICO case, has completely self-destructed from what I can see. And the January 6th case here in Washington is incumbent upon the Supreme Court, which seems to be on the verge of giving Trump some semblance of immunity.
We're going to take a short pause, and we will return with the intrepid Dan Moldea on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow and Renee Martin are producing, and one of our faves, Dan Moldea, is with us, the great reporter based in the Beltway. Earlier we heard from another Beltway legend, David Ignatius, but Dan Moldea is here to talk about Stormy Daniels. On Tuesday, she took the stand at the hush money trial of former President Trump, and it brought him face-to-face with a porn star that he met in 2006. There is the photographic evidence that they met on a golf course. Now, the question is not whether she was paid $130,000 in hush money. That is well documented, but how it was done and whether it was kosher. And Daniels, as Dan noted, had a fast-paced testimony that lasted nearly 5 hours. She's back on the stand today. And it was a sordid afternoon in the courtroom in Manhattan. And it is a tawdry tale. Donald Trump is a married man. He was married then to his third wife, Melania. And she gave birth to their son on March 20th, 2006. Barron is now 18. He's 6'8", I hear, and a good-looking young man, but has not been available for interviews, and neither has the former First Lady. But just a few months later, after his birth on March 20th, Donald Trump is accused of consorting with Stormy Daniels, a porn star, in a hotel room in Lake Tahoe with a security guard standing outside the room. And based on her testimony yesterday, it was an episode that was not well thought out, apparently. There was no protection. Here is Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC commenting on some of the implications of the testimony yesterday from Stephanie Clifford, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels, from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
The first thing that went through my mind is 60-year-old Donald Trump not wearing a condom with a 27-year-old woman who's from Louisiana, a state where a 27-year-old woman or a woman of any age now cannot get an abortion if they make the mistake of having sex with someone like Donald Trump, who's not using a condom. And the idea that that abortion ban that so many women in this country are living with was inflicted on them by the defendant in this case, described today as not wearing a condom.
Dan Moldea, I think we get the impression that if this happened, Donald Trump did not wear a condom, and Stormy Daniels made that case yesterday on the stand. Once again, this could play either way with a jury, and jurors are people who often feel sorry for people who are in a courtroom. It is a sobering thing for anybody. It is humiliating, embarrassing, and in Donald Trump's case, some say he brought this on himself, but others say, look, give the man a break. Your thoughts?
I think, once again, Trump brought this on himself by his denial that this tryst had ever occurred. Clearly it did. The evidence is clear on that yesterday. Again, she went, I think her declaratives about that she hated Trump and that she wants to see him in jail, I mean, that hurt her with the jury, no doubt about that. But again, she spoke so fast that the jury was that the prosecution, they found it very difficult to rein her in. I mean, I've been in enough courtrooms and covered enough trials to have seen, you know, to start to get the feel of what was going on in there. Although I was surprised by the fact that during the sidebar, the judge had said to Trump's attorney, rein in your client, because he's motioning and he's reacting and he's cursing and he's saying words that are being heard by the jury. And so I'd be very curious to see. Apparently the jury is wrapped with attention on this whole thing. They are just fascinated by everything that's going on. But once again, to me, the witness is going to be Karen McDougal. That is going to be, if they bring her in, she's going to pale anything that Stormy Daniels says.
Okay, we are going to the phone lines in a moment. We do ask that you make your remarks brief. But a listener does ask a good question. This is Tom on Bluebonnet about how Stormy apparently went to the bathroom. And while she was in the bathroom, Donald disrobed, and he's on the bed in his underwear, according to her. And obviously, he's a pudgy man, not a man who's probably pleasant to look at. And she comes back from the bathroom, and there he is with his fat frame on the bed. Why didn't she just walk out the room? Why didn't she just leave, Dan?
I don't know. I really haven't studied her testimony. I'm sure she was asked questions like that. But, I mean, there's a lot of what-ifs here. The bottom line is she was brought on to show that there was an affair that had occurred, and I think she supplied ample evidence to show that this tryst, as you call it, and accurately call it, this brief tryst, was that it did occur and that Trump is lying. That is plain and clear to anybody.
Well, and she also claimed that he called her continuously, and of course she was showing off to her friends and putting him on speakerphone, and she said he sometimes called her three times a day wanting to renew his association with the lady he affectionately called Honey Bunch. Rebel and Sherwood. Go ahead.
And this is a year after he was married to Melania, and he's telling this woman he's with momentarily that he and his wife, he confides to her that he and his wife don't even sleep in the same, they have separate rooms. And so, you know, but at the same time, there is, from what I understand, there's zero evidence that the reason why Trump was making the payoff was because he wanted to protect his marriage and his family. There's no evidence of that. The evidence is clear from everything I'm hearing that the reason for the payoffs was in the aftermath of the Trump, you know, the whatever the name of that show was.
The Apprentice?
Access
Hollywood.
Access Hollywood tape. After that came out, if the Stormy Daniels thing would have come out or the Karen McDougal thing would have come out after that, it would have destroyed his campaign. But thank goodness for James Comey, right? James Comey came and saved Trump. Was single-handedly defeated Hillary Clinton and then elected Donald Trump as president.
Yeah, and then he got fired by Trump. Imagine that. Rebel in Sherwood. Rebel, you're on with Dan. Hi, Rebel.
Hi. Thank you, Jim, and thank you, Mr. Muldea, for the work you do. I certainly want to thank who I consider one of the greatest patriots from Louisiana, certainly better than any Republican politician, Stormy Daniels. But my concern, Mr. Muldea, is just what a legal tragedy it is that we have a political hacks on the Supreme Court and federal judiciary that are blocking the most important cases from even getting a trial.
All right. Does Rebel have a point?
Roger that. I mean, I completely agree with the gentleman. It's unbelievable how politicized the Supreme Court has become, and the arguments over the immunity on, I think it was the 25th of April, that entire hearing was almost ridiculous. It was the fact that they have decided that instead of just handling this one case by case, they're going to make a decision for the ages. There's only one president who's ever come up against this particular kind of problem. Not even Richard Nixon had to deal with something like this, had the audacity to try to pull something like this.
Well, there was Bill Trump. What about the listener asked a good question. That's legitimate. What about Bill Clinton?
What about him? Well, I mean, the salaciousness of the grand jury testimony, which was televised as this trial should have been, was such that the Republicans couldn't get enough details about his relationship with his tryst with Monica Lewinsky. Now, when it comes to Trump,
yeah, that's true.
The issue is too much. They wanted all the details. And who was writing that up? Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh was one of the principal writers of that report, of the Starr report.
Yeah, you met him.
And yes, I did.
You met him?
Yes, I did.
He was trying to dump information to you, wasn't he?
Well, I was doing a book on Vince Foster's suicide, and it was a suicide. And Ken Starr's office had done one report on Vince Foster, and I understood that they were doing a second report, but it was going to come after my book came out, and I didn't want to get caught flat-footed on this thing, so I reached out to Starr's people, and they heard that my publisher was Regnery Publishing, which was a right-wing publisher here in town. They held their nose and gave me $100,000 to write this book, and so I did, and they said, well, listen, we have somebody here in our office who gives information, substantive information out. And the person they introduced me to was Brett Kavanaugh, who became late. I filed an affidavit with the court in August of 1998.
Oh, you're going back, yeah, to a contemporary.
And then when he was during his confirmation hearings, I received a call from Camilla's office asking me if I was referring to Brett Kavanaugh, and I filed a second affidavit.
Patrick and Inniswald, please be brief. Patrick, you're on with Dan. Hi, Patrick. Are you there, Patrick?
How y'all doing? To me, Donald Trump was more the victim. I'm trying to see what he did is illegal. He paid a lawyer a legal fee, and he listed it as a legal fee. He paid this lawyer to pay Stormy to keep it hush. If anything, Stormy should be guilty of extortion. I mean, she's not keeping her end of the bargain.
Dan, would you respond?
I'm sure Trump appreciates your support. And the situation is one in which the issue is whether this campaign finance laws come into this, as well as violations of New York policy with regard to filing false reports. Those are the critical issues. And the Fox News crowd is trying to make an issue of the fact that Stormy Daniels' testimony had nothing to do with either of those issues, either with election campaign laws and campaign financing or with New York filing laws. But once again, Stormy Daniels' position there yesterday was to prove that Trump was lying and that the tryst had occurred.
All right. David in Atlanta. David, we're taking you to the break. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having my favorite guest on, Jim. Any man who would have unprotected sex with a porno star is lower than something I can't say on radio at the bottom of the
barrel. All right, what's your question? What's your question?
Well, my question is, Mr. Muldeo, what are the chances of the special prosecutor, Jack Smith, having Judge Cannon removed from that recluse from the case in Florida, which I understand is airtight against Trump?
All right, we'll get Dan's response when we return after this timeout. Your number, 877-217-5757, bank after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and we're wrapping it up with Dan Muldeo, the intrepid reporter, who has unearthed nuggets of discomfort in the private lives of Newt Gingrich, who went to Tulane, Bob Livingston, who went to Tulane and represented Louisiana in Congress and almost succeeded Gingrich as Speaker of the House, and of course, David Bruce Vitter, who went to Tulane and almost became governor of Louisiana and probably would have if not for the reporting by Mr. Muldeo. It seems Louisiana is always in the middle of these sex scandals. Donna Rice, who consorted with Gary Hart and probably cost him the 1988 presidential election, is a native of New Orleans. There was Blaze Starr back in the day with Governor Earl Long. Remember, Paul Newman played him in a movie. Lolita Davidovich played Blaze. And now there's Stormy Daniels. And before we get to David in Atlanta and his question about whether the judge in Florida has gone rogue for Trump, what about your meeting? You met Stormy a few years back, did you not, Dan?
My recollection is that there was, after the Vitter thing, I got a call from
you can say his
name. Bruno?
Vincent Bruno? Bruno. Vincent Bruno.
Vincent Bruno. Vincent, he was a Republican guy. And he asked me if I would speak to a woman who was considering, a woman in the adult entertainment industry, who was thinking about doing some sort of a run for governor against Vitter. And she wanted to talk about Vitter. And the next thing I knew, I got a call from a woman named Stephanie Clifford, and who was very smart and very nice. And, you know, I told her, you know, basically what I had written, and she you know, apparently she did not run. Did she? Did she file papers or anything?
She never ran. She talked about it.
She never ran. Okay. Then maybe I talked her out of it. But she was very nice, very smart, and talked fast. That seems to be her MO. And but I never met her. It was purely over the phone.
And the judge in Florida, which David...
my favorite caller, said, I agree with him. I think this judge has proven to have a real bias against Trump. But with regard to whether Jack Smith, who's a brilliant prosecutor, as to whether he can get her off the bench on this case, I rather doubt it. It's going to be very difficult to do that.
Let's slide in Phil in Jefferson. Phil, you're on with Dan. Good morning, sir. Phil, are you there?
Order on the former president. He gets to walk outside up to a bank of microphones and shoot off his big, fat mouth. Seems to me a gag order means no microphones. How is that even? Oh, God, I'm sorry.
All right. Well, he does have a point, though. Obviously, we're on the air talking about him. People are writing about him. If he doesn't go over the top, I got no problem with it talking to reporters. But of course, he goes out and spews a lot of nonsense, according to some of us. And the judge is about to put him in jail if the judge is serious about this, Dan.
Right. No, I agree. I think the judge is right there. And if the whole thing is, he goes out and he says, "Oh, you know," he tells his supporters, I can't testify because there's a gag order on me." Well, that's just flat out not true. He's going to be given every opportunity in the world to testify if he wants to make that crazy decision, because he will be eaten alive by the prosecutors if he does that. But the bottom line is the gag order on him is he's not allowed to attack witnesses and he's not allowed to attack jurors. He's attacking the prosecutor with no problem, and that's legitimate. He's attacking the judge, who he's calling corrupt and everything else, and that's legitimate. He's allowed to do that. He's just not allowed to intimidate witnesses and members of the jury. That's it. And he can't seem to hold his tongue when it comes to either one of those. But I think he's looking for his Nelson Mandela moment, and he wants to spend a little time in jail so that he can raise more money. I mean, this shows you in the justice, when you have unlimited money for your lawyers, and he does, because he's got the Republican Party paying his legal bills now, it shows you that you can buy justice, or you can certainly buy delays. And right. Which is what's happening right now.
Well, where do you think this?
Delay, delay, delay.
Where do you think this case goes? What's your gut tell you?
You know, you could never figure out what a jury is going to do. One juror in there could hang the jury. I can't imagine there being an acquittal. You know, from what I'm hearing and from what I'm reading, it seems as though the prosecution has put together a very solid case. The witness is coming up. Michael, what's his name? Cohen is going to be difficult for them, but I'm sure they've got that all game planned out. I would have to bet on a conviction, but it's possible that one juror could or two could stand up and say reasonable doubt exists. I'm not voting for conviction. So. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, thanks for your insights as always, Dan Moldea. Quite a
always
pleasure.
A pleasure, Jim, to talk to you.
Take care. See you soon.
Bye-bye.
And Todd Horn is with us, the editor of Tiger Rag, of which yours truly is the proprietor, the Bible of LSU sports. And Todd, over the last year, a little more than that actually, has covered the Sharon Lewis case like no other reporter, the former high-ranking LSU athletic official, associate AD, who alleged all kinds of sexual misconduct within the department, and a jury of her peers found LSU not liable for any damages inflicted on her in a trial that took place recently in Baton Rouge, an all-white jury and a black person who had filed the case. And here we are 5 months later, and Todd Horn, there has, I understand, been a development.
So, yeah. The attorneys for Sharon Lewis, Larry English, out of New York, he also resides in Louisiana, but he's officially a resident of New York. They, less than 20 days after the December 20th trial, filed a motion for a judgment as a matter of law, mm-hmm. or for a new trial. They were attempting to basically get Judge Susie Morgan to step in and override the jury's verdict or get a new trial. Yesterday, Susie Morgan denied that on all counts.
So there apparently will not be a new trial. And Susie Morgan is from New Orleans. All three of the federal judges in Baton Rouge recused themselves from this case. And if the case had been in New Orleans, the outcome quite possibly would have been different. But it wasn't in New Orleans. It's in Baton Rouge, and LSU is tough to beat in Baton Rouge. And the defense team with Michael Victorian and Winston DeQueer, they put on a good case. And ultimately, Sharon Lewis, in the minds of the LSU fandom, I think came out as a person who was not a victim, but somebody who was a hustler. And that's unfortunate because you and I have met her. We know her. I've known her for years. I don't think that's the case. But when you win in court, sometimes people say, if they like the verdict, they say a jury of her peers has decided it. If they don't like it, of course, the opinion is much different. But I would imagine Sharon Lewis right now is a bit disappointed. That might be an understatement.
I just spoke with Larry English, her primary attorney, and they are going to file. He said 100% we're filing an appeal with the Fifth Circuit Court. Now, that would be the appeal of the original trial verdict. This was like an intermediate step where they were trying to get the verdict overturned. Mm-hmm. And the four main reasons that they cited in their motion were surrounding the Title IX retaliation claims, the Title VII retaliation claims, the hostile work environment claim, the juror misconduct claim, and the LSU statements from the defense counsel that you just mentioned, where they just basically said in their opening and closing statements that this was a hustle, blatantly stated it was a hustle. Morgan came down on LSU's side in all four of those categories.
But in her jury instructions, when she sent the case to the jury, which only deliberated about an hour, right?
Well, technically, they deliberated less than 3 hours, but they had an hour and a half lunch.
Okay, so let's say an hour and a half. Right. In her jury instructions, she was giving an indication that Lewis's people had put on a good case.
She did. Her instructions were like, I'm going to blow this probably, but I think it was close to 50 pages of instructions. And it was very clear that Lewis's people, according to those instructions, had put on a solid case when it came to Title IX and Title VII.
And the jury decided they had not put on a good case, and that's the way the system works. Now, Frank on Airline says, Jim, shut up. Sharon Lewis is a liar, and Les Miles was a victim, and you should be ashamed of yourself for disparaging our former coach.
Yeah, and apparently that's the sentiment of the jury and of most of the people in Baton Rouge and probably the state of Louisiana. Unfortunately, the evidence, despite these motions, doesn't necessarily point to Les Miles being pure, shall we say.
Well, he settled another lawsuit. That's been in
well,
the
public.
Well,
that's the crux. That's the crux of this.
And he... He has disappeared, and he lost his job at Kansas. He got fired there as a result, although he got some nice walking away money. He manages to get fired in places and get paid. That seems to be what happens in a lot of venues now. But the fact is Sharon Lewis is lost. There is a state matter still ongoing, and my guess is that it will be very difficult for her to win in a courtroom in Baton Rouge.
I believe that the attorneys for Sharon Lewis are changing their opinion about the viability of them winning in the state of Louisiana under any circumstance, but yet they're still filing an appeal.
And has English filed any other actions?
Well, he's filed a $20 million defamation lawsuit against Taylor Porter.
And the former law firm of LSU. What's that about?
Correct.
Quickly. What's that one about? Basically, I didn't know about this one.
Basically, that they defamed him in court documentation, which led to his being sanctioned by the state court, and that the state court is ignoring all
and
the evidence.
That one is still under review by Judge Bo Higginbotham, right?
They've also asked to have him recused or dismissed from the case.
Well, we'll follow it. Thank you, Todd. Interesting story that continues. Until tomorrow, thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.